Any questions about anything from last time?
About anything? I want to spend some time sort of tying up loose ends before I start going into a theme again. I wanted to remark that the thing I showed you about deriving the heat equation for the hot wire problem, it works in much more generality. So for the heat equation in R3, for example, this is a fun thing to do. Remember I took the little interval from X1 to X2 of my hot wire and played around and got what I called a control volume. But if I'm in R3, a control volume could just be a blob. So think this is a blob and it has a surface. Let's call this blob omega. And I might, for a control volume, I might as well take a nice smooth potato-like thing. And let's call the surface S. So the surface of that blob is S. And this omega is called a control volume. So I want to derive the heat equation. Maybe say in a block of metal. And so in this block of metal, this is an imaginary volume. It's just a potato out of the middle someplace. And so I can do exactly what I did with the hot wire problem. And the heat in that control volume would be a solid three-dimensional integral. So triple integral over omega of the temperature, so U is the temperature, it would be depend on the three variables X, Y, and Z, and T, and I would integrate the temperature dV. So if this was, if I was doing the heat equation in water, then this would really be the calories. This would be the amount, you know, the one calorie is the amount to raise 1 gram of water 1 degree centigrade. So this dV would be like a little cubic centimeter of water, and multiplying by U would give you the heat content of that little cubic centimeter, and adding it all up gives you the total heat content. Of course, you'd use delta X, delta Y, delta Z, and make them even smaller than 1 cubic centimeter to get the exact value. But if this is not water, then it's not. Then there'd be a constant here. So, and that would have to do with the thermal conductivity or whatever they call it.
Heat capacity.
What is it?
Heat capacity.
Heat capacity. And the other one that's going to be, the Kelvin's law is the, has a different name. The Kelvin's law comes next. So that's the amount of heat in omega. And now the rate that it changes would be d by d t of that. So I'd take d by dt, partial derivative. Well, I guess this would actually be an ordinary derivative, because this thing integrates out to be a function of time alone. But then there's also Kelvin's law, which tells you that heat flows at a rate proportional to the temperature gradient. And so if you have a surface and you want to figure out how much heat is flowing past the surface, that's exactly what the flux is for. So this is using Kelvin's law. The flux would be the integral over the surface of the temperature gradient dotted with the vector d area. That measures the rate that heat is flowing out of a little patch on the surface. And you add it up over the whole surface, that would measure how much the heat is flowing out through that control volume S. And so that's the only way, if this thing is changing, it's because some heat is flowing out and in. And when this could give you the net outflow. And if you think of it, if that gradient is pointing out everywhere, it means that it's hotter on the outside than it is on the inside. That would be the, is that true? Yeah, it's hotter on the inside. It's hotter on the outside than it is on the inside. That means heat would be flowing in. And so that would make this increase. So the sign is correct here. And there would be another K here having to do with the material. And so the next step, so that's the physics. This is just conservation of energy. The only way this can be changing is if some is flowing in and out by Kelvin's law. And that flux represents the net inflow. So this is a flux of the temperature gradient. And that would be equal to the net inflow of heat. Or it'd be proportional to the net, constant times the net inflow of heat. So I guess C times the flux. I guess in this case I called it K. Okay, and so the next thing, if you're going to start thinking in terms of calculus, I can take that partial derivative inside the integral and get that the C times the triple integral over omega of du dt, and integrating with respect to volume. And on this side, I'm going to use the divergence theorem. So a famous theorem of multivariable analysis is that that double integral is equal to a solid integral of the divergence of the gradient times the d volume. So this thing is it's called the divergence theorem, and it relates a flux to an integral of the divergence. The flux of a vector field in terms of divergence, solid integral. And Gauss invented or discovered the divergence theorem when he was studying electricity and magnetism. It has its most physical meaning for me when it comes to fluid mechanics. That flux would be the rate of outflow of a fluid, and this divergence represents the amount of fluid that's being created in a little box, and that's a pretty easy thing to see. So when you think in those physical terms, the divergence theorem is very believable, and you can prove it mathematically. Okay, then the divergence of the gradient is the Laplacian. And so now what we have is that the integral, if I put these under one thing, I would have the integral over omega, and then I'd have here C du dt minus K times the Laplacian with respect to volume is a big fat zero. And here's how you derive the heat equation. This is true about any blob, any potato-shaped thing. So if there was some place where I'd say this was positive, I would integrate over that a little blob where it's positive, maybe a little ball, in fact, and that would give me a strictly positive integral. So the only way this could be true for all possible spots, all possible control volumes, is this thing inside here is identically zero. So since omega, that blob, was arbitrary, so we conclude that the thing inside that integral must be equal to zero. This thing. That's the heat equation. So maybe I should repeat that argument. Let's say it's positive someplace. Because this thing would be continuous, I'd make a little ball where it's strictly positive, and that would give me a contradiction. If it was negative someplace, I'd make a little ball and I'd get something strictly negative on that ball. And so that can't happen. It's got to be identically zero.
So that's the same argument in three dimensions as I did on the hot wire problem. So that's the heat equation. The R3 heat equation.
And of course you can do it in R2 too. And in place of the divergence theorem, you'd have Green's theorem. Or I guess it can be called the divergence theorem in R2 also. But they're all highly related.
Questions about that? Okay, I think I'm going to stop talking about heat for a while. I wanted to go back and sort of clean up the way I've been talking about convergence of Fourier series. Because now that you're reading chapter 3 of Stein, he kind of does things in a different order than I've done it. It's going to amount to all the same material, but I've chosen a different order to do just so I can get to the things I want to do faster. So let me summarize what we know at the moment about convergence of Fourier series. I showed you Fayer's theorem. For continuous functions, meaning for continuous 2 pi periodic functions, I can approximate them uniformly by trigonometric polynomials. So 2 pi periodic functions. And so I needed them to be periodic. I mean, I needed them to be continuous.
They couldn't have jumps.
And I used that to show you Parseval's identity. So Fayer's implied real quickly the Parseval identity for 2 pi periodic continuous functions. Parseval's identity holds for much more than that, but that at the moment that's all we know it for. Okay, so we know that. And 3,
if something is C2 smooth,
the Fourier coefficients go to 0 really fast. So if F is 2 pi periodic, and C2 smooth, then the Fourier coefficients go to 0 really fast. Remember that was at the in Stein's notation, the nth Fourier coefficient is less than or equal to constant over n squared.
And that's a summable series. And that means the Fourier series converges uniformly.
So the Weierstrass M test shows it converges uniformly.
And we know, well, let's see, I showed that it converges to F.
And the Fourier series converges to F uniformly.
So we know that fact.
And from lecture 9,
at spots where F is C1 smooth, I get convergence at that spot.
I showed that the Fourier series converges to F of X . And I'm going to go back and look at that proof for a minute just to review it. Because I did it earlier than Stein did it. I showed that the Fourier series converges to f, the value of f, at points x, where f is c1 from the left and the right. Meaning it has a right and left-hand derivative. So those left-hand and right-hand derivatives might be different, so there might be a kink. If they're the same, there's no kink. Okay, so let's see. Another thing I showed is that Bessel's inequality holds, and if you look at my proof, if I could have f being just piecewise continuous, so we could have jumps. Bessel's holds for more general f, for f that are merely piecewise continuous, meaning they could have jumps. So let's see, what's a piecewise continuous thing? It's continuous on this interval, and then it could have a jump. Like that. So jumps are okay. I don't care what the value is at the jumps. But on intervals, there'd be finitely many intervals here. I could cut it up where it would be continuous. My proof of Bessel's theorems works for that kind of function. Okay, so now I want to go back to my lecture 9 day and take a look at that day. So let's see, this was the exercise you did in Stein, number 1, that when something's 2 pi periodic, then the integral over any length of thing that's 2 pi is the same. And so that was an exercise. And what we wanted to do was study the convergence of the Fourier series that day. And so I wrote out the real Fourier series, which is equivalent to a complex version. And Andrew, somebody pointed out that when I'm talking about convergence of Fourier series, I'm talking about the convergence of this partial sum. Maria was on her who mentioned this. Convergence of this partial sum to the function is what you mean when you talk about pointwise convergence of Fourier series. And that's what I wanted to show this day. This is the real version, and it's convenient to write it in the complex case because then this stuff gets particularly nice to write down. And we can use geometric series because e to the inx is e to the ix to the n. And so when I wrote out the Fourier sum and put in what the c's were, it made this thing that I could mess around with. And I pulled it apart and wrote it out long. Let's see. I wrote out the sum and I pulled the function outside and I saw this thing here. This thing is called the Dirichlet kernel. And it's e to the I n, whatever this number is. That's the variable in the Dirichlet kernel. And so I have my Fourier series written. This is called a convolution integral because it's sort of jumbling up f with this Dirichlet kernel at a translated spot. And notice it's an integral from minus pi to pi. The function's 2 pi periodic, and all of these things are 2 pi periodic. So I'm going to be able to shift this thing in a minute to make it a nicer looking integral. All right, that's the Dirichlet kernel. And when I write it like this, I realize, aha, these things are geometric series. And you'll notice, I don't think Stein puts his 1 over 2 pi in his Dirichlet kernel. But I want the integral of the Dirichlet kernel to be 1. So that's why I put my 2 pi there.
Some books do it, some books don't.
Okay, so I messed around and summed those geometric series and showed that the Dirichlet kernel was actually this simple thing, a sine over a sine. It gets gigantic at the origin because you use L'Hopital's rule. This would give you n plus half over n plus over a half, which is a gigantic number, so it's big at zero. Its integral is one because if you, each of these integrals would be zero except the one that corresponds to n equals zero. And then you'd be integrating one from minus pi to pi, so you get 2 pi divided by 2 pi. The integral of the Dirichlet kernel is one. That's a key feature. Because all the things in the sum are 2 pi periodic, the thing is 2 pi periodic. And you can see this, because sine is odd, this quotient is even. So the Dirichlet kernel is 2 pi periodic and even. And there's a graph of it. It concentrates its mass right here near zero. The integral is 1, and it gets gigantic there. And outside, it tends to 0. Well, let's see. Yeah, it does. Does it? We have to think about that. We don't have to think about that. That was a property of the Thayer kernel. The Dirichlet kernel is trickier. And we just had just barely enough to get what we needed out of it. So when I proved that, when I was proving it, let's see, there's the geometric series I played around with that day and got the formula. Then I'm going to write, I want to calculate the Fourier series minus the function at a point x. So x is fixed here. And I had this thing that I wrote out for the Fourier series, and I did this trick that f is just a number, and the integral of the Fourier of the Dirichlet kernel is 1. So I subtract, this is minus f of x times 1, and then I can shove this under one integral. And to make that cleaner, I did a change of variables to shift this. And that shifted it to a different integral. And the translation makes it a cleaner looking integral. And then I can, since it's a length 2 pi interval, I was able to shift it back and get this nice form so that I can combine those two things. Oops. Right, so my new way of writing Sn was this. And that made me able to combine these two integrals in a clean way. And I have dn of t times this thing. And the key that made this work, I'm going to look at this integral. And here's where I needed the C1 business. I want to use L'Hopital's rule to get this thing here bounded. I'm dividing by sine t over 2 when I pull this apart. So this is the numerator of the Dirichlet kernel, and I pull the denominator over here. And this thing on the top, if f is continuous, would be 0 at t equals 0, because it'd be f of x minus f of x. And sine of t over 2 is 0 at 0. If f is differentiable, then I could use L'Hopital's rule to see, aha, this is nice and bounded. So that day I was taking it easy and just assuming that f was C1 smooth. But now if I look at this, my x is fixed. I could take a limit from the left and a limit from the right and see that this thing is bounded. That's like using a right-handed version of L'Hopital's and a left-side version of L'Hopital's. That shows me that this thing has bounded limits as I come from the left and right. So this function in here would be bounded. And in fact, it would be, that's all I needed to know. And so having that hypothesis that it's C1 from the left and the right makes that bounded. And next, I realized this kind of looks like the Fourier sine coefficient. The annoying thing is that n plus a half right there. So I'm going to use a trig identity for the sum of two angles to get that
to get it to be sine of nt. And this is the trig identity, and it's got cosine and sines, t over 2, in it. And when I do that, then I get sine nt times this thing, which is nice and bounded. And I realize, aha, these are the Fourier coefficients of this function. And now Bessel's inequality tells me those Fourier coefficients go to 0. And so my Bessel's inequality works whenever this thing is piecewise continuous, which, with my hypothesis, I get that. So let's see, what should I have? What do I need to make this work? I need my f to be piecewise continuous, and at the point x, I need left and right C1 differentiability.
Does piecewise continuous include, like, unbounded?
No, I'm going to take mine piecewise continuous to be on intervals, so it would be bounded. I'm not going to start thinking about unbounded functions for a while. So, now that I'm looking at my proof more carefully, so the last step is Bessel's inequality. Those Fourier coefficients go to 0, and that shows convergence of the Fourier series at x to the correct value. And so that was... Yeah. And so that day, if I look at it more carefully, what do I need? I need piecewise continuity of f, and then this special x, I get convergence. And if I wanted to be even fancier, all I really needed was a Lipschitz estimate. But I don't think I want to get that fancy for the time being. Okay, so let me go back. Any questions about that? Yeah.
It's like way up when you show that the Dirichlet kernel evaluated at 0 is you use like L'Hopital's rule to get it.
Right.
You like don't even need that, right? Because like you can just like that thing just like 1/2π times like 2n+1. No, the one below it. Yeah. And like that's just like what you get when you put in 0, because it's like everything.
Oh, if you know that sine theta over theta tends to 1?
No, I'm just saying, like, it's even easier than that. Like, if you literally just put in 0 into the Dirichlet kernel, then you get 2n+1 terms, all of them.
Oh, I see what you mean. Right. So if I put x equals 0 in here, I've got...
Yeah. I'm just saying, it's just, like, easier. Like you just don't need, like, all of them.
That's true.
Because yeah. That thing's 2n,
right.
2n+1.
Right. So, but I guess if I was going to be more careful that day, I would say, I'm going to use the sum formula for geometric series, and it works great, except when I'm summing 1.
Yeah.
Then I can't do 1/1 minus.
Also, when do you use that in the...
What?
When do you use that in... Oh, that's just like a property of the Dirichlet kernel that blows up at origin. That's all it is.
Right. I mean, it's obviously a nice smooth thing, because I'm adding up 2n+1... smooth thing, so it's got to be smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when I wanted to do the sum of a geometric series here, when I divide by 1 minus z, I better not have z equal 1.
Yeah.
So this works great when z is e to the ix, but not if x is 0.
Yeah.
And at that spot, you have to calculate it some other way.
Yeah.
And that's why I use L'Hopital's, but you're right, it's obvious the value. If you look at the sum of 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 2n+1 of them, or whatever there are. Okay. So let's see. Let me go back to what we know. So lecture 9, I showed that at places where f is C1 smooth from the left and right, and f is continuous in the rest of the, or piecewise continuous. So, and f piecewise continuous elsewhere, then I get convergence at that x. Okay, so if you look at Stein, what he's really trying to get to, he's trying to have a new class of functions that are called integrable.
and he's going to use, I think he's using Riemann integrable in the beginning. What we, it's a subtle thing, what you mean by integrable in the context of Fourier series. It's pushing you to invent the Lebesgue integral, and we're not going to get that advanced here. So I am avoiding following Stein and talking about Riemann integrable functions as what we're after here. I just want my functions to be piecewise defined and nice enough to make this stuff work.
Okay, so that's what I've actually shown you so far. And now I want to think about what happens at jumps. Let's see. Okay, so I want to have my, let's think about it. It turns out all you have to do is think about one jump, one kind of jump. And I'll pick an easy jump. I'm going to pick this function. We've already looked at one jump, that minus one and plus one over here. That had a nice jump and it was easy to analyze and think about. But I want a jump that's I can make to be 2π periodic. And I'm going to take my jump at the origin for today. So I'm going to have it jump from minus 1 to plus 1. And I'm going to make it, on this side I'm going to make it go from minus pi, it's just going to be this line that goes to minus 1. And over here, it's going to be a line that goes from 1 down to 0 here. That's kind of a sawtooth function, so I'll call it S of X. Those are supposed to look like straight lines. So that has a jump, and it jumps from minus 1 to 1. And notice that that's an odd function. So that sawtooth function is odd. S of X is odd. And let's take the 2π periodic extension. And the reason I made these things zero here so they'd hook up and they wouldn't jump. I don't want any jumps. I've only got one jump, namely the jump that's right smack in the middle. And they hook up at zero there, so there's no other jumps anyplace else. So S, and it's an odd. That means all the cosine coefficients, a naught and a n, are equal to zero for all n, for odd functions. And that means that the Fourier series is only sine terms. So the Fourier series, S of x, is equal to its Fourier series. And let's see, the Fourier series would be the sum from n equal 1 to infinity, the sine terms. And notice that the function is perfectly C1 everywhere except at the jump. And at the endpoints, it's got left and right hand derivatives. So it converges to the function everywhere except at the jump. For x unequal to 0. Because it's nice and C1 smooth, it's just a line. And even though it has a kink at pi and minus pi, well, it doesn't have a kink, does it? Because when I do this 2-periodic, it goes down like that right there. And so there is actually no kink even at the left and right endpoints. So it converges great there. For x unequal to 0, there's jumps at 2π, 4π, etc. But so let's say for x unequal to 0 on the interval minus pi to pi.
But this converges even at x equals 0 because sine of 0 is 0. And so the aha here is the Fourier series converges to zero. In fact, it's just a sum of zero. Zero at x equals zero. And that's not equal to s, because I didn't define s at zero. But what's interesting is that is the midpoint of the jump. And that's going to turn out to be the way all jumps behave in Fourier series. And I'm going to explain why you can figure that out today. So that's the midpoint of the jump. Okay, so what if I had a function that had to jump? So this is the thinking for today. Let's take a g of x with a jump. And I'm going to make the jump at the origin, at zero. So how about a graph? Let's make g look like this. So g is going to come in. It'll be, I'll give it value a here, and then it's going to jump to b. If you were Gibbs, you'd say, I understand what happens to my basic jump function, and if I want to make this thing, if I want to relate to this, I would subtract something to make that jump go away. So the brilliant idea is, here's the brilliant idea. Let's see, what should I subtract? I'll take my g of x, and I want to subtract the bump sum function I understand. So let's see, I got to think pretty hard here. Let's see. There's my sawtooth function up there. Where is it? If I add 1 to it, that would move this up to 0 and that up to 2. And then it would jump from 0 to 2. So if I multiplied that by a half, I would jump from 0 to 1. And I claim, if you start thinking hard, I want a function that's going to be a from the left, and then I would have 1/2 of s of x minus, plus 1. This jumps from 0 to 1 at x equals 0. So this would be coming in at a, and then wham, this would jump to 1, and I want it to suddenly be b after that. So I should multiply this by b minus a. That has no jump. All right. So by subtracting this, I close that jump. Has no jump. At zero. So the Fourier series for this thing converges to the value of without a jump. And I know that. So what I'm trying to say is, we conclude. So this, the Fourier series for this thing, I should call this something maybe. Let's call this whole mess H. The Fourier series for H converges to the right value, the no jump value. To its value at zero. And now when I put, so Fourier series are linear, of course. The Fourier series for this would be equal to h plus the Fourier series for that. And so what we conclude, because we understand the s of x1, conclude the Fourier series for G converges to the midpoint of the jump.
Well, it turns out there's nothing special about the origin. You can translate Fourier series and move jumps to the origin to study them. The translation formulas are very simple. So there's nothing special about the origin.
And what we conclude is there's a basic theorem. I think I mentioned it just to say what we were heading for way back. Let's suppose that F has piecewise C1 with jumps. C1 smooth with jumps.
At kinks and smooth spots, the Fourier series converges to F.
So
that's where a kink is, where it has a left-hand derivative and a right-hand derivatives.
So at kinks and smooth spots, the Fourier series converges to F.
And at jumps, it converges to the midpoint of the jump.
And it converges to the midpoint of the jump at jumps. And then the only thing you have to think about is what happens at the endpoints. And I drew the picture way back. The endpoints you figure out like this. So let's see, here's a function. Here would be a kink. Here's a jump. And then I didn't want to go that far. Oops. Let's make this be pi, and this be minus pi. Then, here's an A, and here's a B.
And you make this thing biperiodic, so the value it converges to at this spot would be the
A plus B over 2. A plus B over 2 is what you can converge to at that spot. And here this would be the midpoint of this jump. Even at this kink,
it has a left derivative and a right derivative. They're not equal, but at the kink, it converges there by the argument from lecture 9.
And at the...
So we know that now.
How much time do I have?
Were there any questions you wanted to ask me about the homework that you turned in on Monday?
Does the Gibbs phenomenon happen at the jumps as well?
Ah, yes it does. And there, you know how you understand it? Is you mess around with that sawtooth thing, and you study the Gibbs phenomenon there, and it translates to this. Because if the sawtooth does the jumping funny thing, then this, when you unravel it with the G and the things you subtract to make the jump go away, that doesn't do the Gibbs, but the sawtooth does. So the G is going to do it too. And what's going to happen there, I guess I can do this with my... it's going to be close, this Fourier series would be summing to something close here, but then it would overshoot
by 9%, and then undershoot by 9% here and get close like that. And I could squeeze this overshooting and undershooting and make it smaller, smaller intervals where it does that. But it will always do that. That's the Gibbs phenomenon. And it, notice this, these would all go through the midpoint here. So it, the convergence would stick right at the midpoint there and do this overshooting, but the interval where it overshoots can be made smaller and smaller. And so the convergence would be nice along those nice smooth parts. And if you're an electrical engineer, that's really annoying because that would be like a clicking sound. if you're trying to simulate a signal that has jumps, those are like major staticky clicks to an electrical engineer. And it's an annoyance if you're trying to simulate a signal. And you got those nasty little clicks going on. I wanted to think about something today. I prove Parseval's for continuous functions, but I want to start thinking about Parseval's for non-continuous functions. And so here's the, if you look in Stein, you'll see that he's doing stuff like this every now and then. Let's say I have a function that's continuous on pieces. So, continuous. That Parseval's identity has to do with integrals. And so I can get a continuous function that has that's close to this and makes the integral close too. So the big idea is I get myself a continuous function that hugs this one, and at a jump, it takes a jump really fast. So it would go down to zero really fast and then jump here really fast and then hang with this one for a while. Then the integral would be really, when I subtract these two things, this one's going to be nice and continuous, and this one's not, but the difference of the integrals are these little tiny blips, and those are small areas. So that red thing is not close to the blue one. So the red thing is continuous. And an interesting thing is that the integral of blue minus red squared dx is very small, can be made small. It's going to allow me to generalize some of the things I know. I know facts for this red thing that's continuous. I know Fayer's theorem. I know Parseval's identity. It means that I'm going to be able to conclude Parseval's identity for things that have jumps by approximating by this continuous nice thing. And where the jumps occur, I can make this integral small. It's just a little blip. It's bounded. And if I make that blip really narrow, it's going to just make this integral small. And I didn't want to get too technical at the end here today, so I'll save doing that carefully for next time. So if you combine this picture with Fayer's theorem, you can prove Parseval's for functions that have jumps. And that's nice to know. Okay, that's enough for today.
So when you calculated this the sawtooth function.
Yeah.
Right. So the ands are all the a0 and the an are all zero, right?
Right.
And your b0 is also gonna be zero, right?
There is no b0.